Well, a very happy Saturday evening to you all, everyone. What a gorgeous day in the city of Chicago and beyond. I'm circling today on the calendar because in a few months when it's winter or another month and a half when it gets really cold and people start to complain, they're like, you know, there's never any fall days really in Chicago. No, this was one of them. Really, the last couple of days have been incredibly gorgeous. Hope you got to enjoy some time outside or just cracking open the windows here today. We got a lot to get to, but we're starting with crazy lawsuits and the one from 2013 that eventually grew into a big class action lawsuit against Subway, the fast food giant, and something wrong started with a teenager. I got three callers on the line right now, so I'm going to go with the one that actually has or is from Munster, Indiana, because at least Munster is a food item, right? It's like cheese, so it kind of fits in here with the topic. Mark, how are you doing here today?
All right, John, not bad. We spell Munster a little different than the cheese itself, but it's close enough.
Yeah, are you sick of jokes about Munster cheese and living in Munster, Indiana?
Nah, I'm more upset with the Munster, like the from the TV show.
Oh, the Munster, yes. Okay, yeah, I could definitely see that. All right, so why did the teenager and others sue Subway?
The foot-long sandwich is not quite a foot long.
Yeah, 11 inches. Someone actually measured it. And the teenager wasn't the first one. Some other folks have done it. It eventually ended up in a settlement. And now Subway actually then had to, they decided to make the claim, yes, we will be measuring our bread to make sure that they're a foot long. Same with the 6-inch, making sure that it's 6-inch. And I haven't gotten the ruler out, but I'm always left satisfied after one, so I feel pretty good.
Yeah, they make a good sandwich. And that 1 inch may be good for my diet after all.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe 11 is probably the best thing for me, but I'll take 12. Hey, Mark, have a great day. Did you do anything fun today? Did you get outside at all?
I officiated a couple of high school football games and then had to go to work.
Hey, well, sounds like work leading into work. You must love doing that, though.
Yeah, it's good exercise getting out there and being with the kids.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for calling in, Mark. We appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good day. Yeah, enjoy the show.
Yeah, thank you. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We're taking you till 8 o'clock tonight. I know on Saturday sometimes you have to have your pencil and your scorecard ready just to line up exactly what's happening, but that's the schedule here for today. 312-981-7200 going to be the phone call. Here's what we got coming up on the show. In just a little bit, we're going to chat with a University of Illinois professor. The Bennett Academy story blew up this week. I think everyone's well aware of what happened about the lacrosse coach who was offered a position. Then she wrote down that her wife was her emergency contact. And then she wasn't offered the job and then was. She took it. Anyways, I think everyone pretty happy with the way that resolved. But I really didn't get a great answer about why that is, that Catholic institutions kind of have the power to do that. Not saying one way is right or wrong, but that they are even able to do that. Because I know Illinois has special protections for LGBTQ+ Americans, or Illinoisans, I should say, about getting fired or not getting offered jobs. So we've got a lawyer who knows this stuff and is going to break down exactly what happened in that case. And broadly speaking, what different institutions are or allowed to do when it comes to your employment. And the answer might actually surprise you. And Michael LaRoy is also going to break down a little bit about the Biden administration's vaccine or testing mandate, I guess you could say, using OSHA to enforce that any employer that has over 100 employees must either require vaccine or regular testing. And I had a chance to talk to Michael LaRoy a little bit before, and he's going to break it down and what the basis is from a legal perspective. I'm kind of surprised about his answer, too, so you're going to want to hear that. That's coming up in just a little bit. Then the great Michael Miller and Jim McGing, I love these guys, from the law firm Miller and McGing, are going to sit down, and we got a nice long conversation with them here today. And they want to take some of your calls, too, 312-981-7200. That'll be a little bit later on. But they just specialize in all things personal injury. They've got great stories. They were like best friends, or they knew each other back in high school, and they've reunited all these years later to open up this law firm. Two really good people, and we'll be chatting about workers' compensation laws, and I will definitely ask them my golf ball question because I really want to know. And then later in the show, we're going to chat with a lawyer who really specializes in insurance law about restaurants who maybe could get some money that they lost during the pandemic based on their insurance. Insurers, no surprise, fighting on that. So a lot to get here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Quick break, then more here on WGN. Back here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, here on 720 WGN. Thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us. John Hansen here. Really appreciate your time. And two of the big stories that have been making news have to deal with employment and jobs and how it relates to a lot of different things. So I went to one of the best here, professor from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, my alma mater from the School of Labor and Employment Relations and College of Law, Professor Michael Leroy. How are you doing, Professor?
I'm well, John. It's good to join you today.
Yeah, it's really great to chat with you. Before we went live, we were talking about my favorite bars on Champaign-Urbana's campus. Let's move on to more important things, of course.
let's do that.
One of the biggest stories of the week came out of the western suburbs at Bennett Academy, where a potential lacrosse coach had been offered a job, then it was rescinded because she's gay. I know that private companies in many states can still fire someone for being LGBTQ+, but here in Illinois, I know that we have stronger protections for those folks in terms of employment. So broadly speaking, Professor, and at Bennett, how is this still possible legally?
Well, I can't speak specifically to Bennett, of course, and you're not asking me to, but in general, I think this relates to something called the ministerial exemption. So in our federal employment law called Title VII, religious institutions, religious employers are exempt from discrimination laws on a very narrow sense. So a Catholic institution can require, can have only hiring for Catholic priests, a very commonsensical notion. Mm-hmm. But in the past several years, the Supreme Court has looked at something called the ministerial exemption. And what they've done in two decisions is broadened the definition of a minister. So in one case involving a Lutheran parochial school, there was a teacher who had a health issue and she was on leave. She tried to come back from it. She was denied reinstatement, and she sued under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Her particular job, John, called for religious instruction, and there was a requirement that she be something on the order of a called instructor, which is a term in that church, meaning that she has some kind of official position. So the Supreme Court went beyond saying just a minister can be Catholic, Lutheran, etc., and said a teacher in a parochial school, if they have this specific designation, the discrimination laws don't apply to them. And more recently, this was broadened in a case. It involved a teacher who didn't have this official designation, and a majority of the Supreme Court ruled she had an age discrimination claim, and the Supreme Court said the discrimination laws do not apply to a Catholic institution when they're employing a teacher who teaches 30 minutes of religious education. To your observation, Illinois has a different set of laws, and the Supreme Court has not specifically looked at that sort of interaction between federal and state law with respect to the ministerial exemption. John, I'll just give you one other quick explanation.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's not an explanation, it's a possibility. And that is, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in a remarkable case. It's called Bostick versus Clayton County. It ruled that Title VII, which is the mainstream anti-discrimination law in employment, prohibits discrimination on the basis of LGBTQ status. And it was written by a conservative justice, Neil Gorsuch. So, you know, maybe somebody in that institution said, well, you know, We're going to be bucking up against we've got this ministerial exemption thing going on, but with respect to a gay or lesbian employee, we are not on solid ground.
When I had heard of the ministerial exemption, I only really thought of LGBTQ+, sexual orientation, gender identity cases. You mentioned age. So in theory, does the ministerial exemption give a church or religious institution the opportunity to discriminate against anyone for anything? Race, creed, color?
That's the implication of these rulings, although I haven't seen that. But so and I get the wow. When you read these opinions, what the majority opinions are saying, and I just want to say up front, I disagree with their reasoning. But they make the point that government should not be interfering in the affairs and the autonomy of a religious institution. And I don't think necessarily that all of these justices are saying that this is a good thing, but I think what they are saying as a group is that government doesn't belong in the business interfering, especially in employment.
Hey, other big story that we've had in the last couple of weeks, President Biden asking OSHA, Occupational Health and Safety Administration. Did I get that right? I think
you
so.
You did.
Hey, yes, and I'm not looking, I promise. I think I kind of remember that somewhere in the back of my brain.
You're good.
Using them to kind of regulate that companies with over 100 employees either mandate a vaccine or regular testing. I think a lot of people have, well, some people have screamed from the high heavens about it. Some are very much in favor. Some are against. What's the legal standing for President Biden and his administration on this?
So it's a, John, it's a multi-tiered approach. It is really a breathtaking set of regulations. If I can back up half a step, he's patterned this after Ronald Reagan's very broad directive to all cabinet secretaries to implement drug testing procedures, both for their federal sector workers and for the private sector that they were engaged in. Some of our listeners might remember Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs emphasis. That was her her campaign theme. And so Ronald Reagan took this to heart and he implemented it. And in two cases that went all the way to the Supreme Court, in both cases, the Supreme Court upheld these tests. And the argument that was made at the time was that these are impermissible searches and seizures of a person's body. In one case, it was a urinalysis. So the urine sample is a personal effect. If you read the Fourth Amendment, it protects personal effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And these were broadly distributed tests. There was no probable cause element. Supreme Court, somewhat surprisingly, said there's not a constitutional problem here. In another case, there was a mandatory blood draw if a train employee, even a conductor, was on a train where there was any kind of reportable incident.
To see if something was in their system, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the court ruled not a constitutional problem. Go ahead and do it. And then it became widely dispersed in the private sector. I think that's what Biden is doing here with indicating that he's the employer in chief. He's going to order vaccinations in his capacity as commander in chief for the military, employer in chief for federal workers. He then has an element that applies to contractors, federal contractors. We always think of Defense Department and like, that's people who make missiles and tanks and guns. That is true. But it's also people who make cheese for, a school program, that kind of thing, a federally funded school program. And so I would expect courts, including the Supreme Court, most of them, but the Supreme Court, if it ever came to it, if they're following precedent, they will uphold Biden's authority in those areas. Now, John, what you were asking 3 minutes ago was about OSHA. And on that, I think if you had to ask me, I would say I would expect that regulation to have real difficulty because conservative judges, they're hostile to OSHA regulation. They often believe it is overreach. There's a legal doctrine called Chevron deference, which has been around for 40 years, but it means if an administrative agency thinks it's a good idea, we, the court, should defer to it unless it's a bad reason. And it's very clear that justices such as Brett Kavanaugh really do not think that's appropriate. They think they have a legal version of it's the deep state, and we as judges should be more, we should scrutinize these more.
So I just want to make sure I understand. Yeah. So you think that Biden's federal mandates will hold up, but there's a chance that these more recent OSHA, mandates are maybe a little bit more on shaky legal ground.
I do. And I can boil it down real quickly for you. SeaWorld had a tragic incident. I think it was 2010, 2011. Dawn Brancho, a trainer, was killed during a live performance. An orca grabbed her off the deck and drowned her. And OSHA enforced against SeaWorld and fined them. This went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Merrick Garland, now Attorney General and the spurned Supreme Court nominee or appointee, wrote the majority opinion saying that OSHA had authority to fine SeaWorld. Brett Kavanaugh had the sole dissenting opinion. It's a great read. It's very entertaining. He talks about the freedom to face a fastball coming at you at 98 miles per hour and get in a race car and all that. But it's very clear. It's a libertarian perspective saying this is government overreach. Well, Merrick Garland didn't make it to the Supreme Court. Brett Kavanaugh did. So I do think you have the makings for a conservative majority that would be hostile to the OSHA piece of the vaccine regulation.
This is fascinating. And we are out of time, Professor LeRoy. I feel like I'm just getting started with my questions. Please come back again, okay?
I look forward to it, John. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate that. Ooh, great conversation there. Plenty more coming up on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Time for the news on WGN. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. It's like a prime time Let's Get Legal here in the evening hours. Yeah, we're going to let loose here a little bit, kick off our shoes, answer some pressing fun legal questions, 312-981-7200. I say that sarcastically, but I've got so many questions. And the two gentlemen I've got across from me right now are incredible. They're just good human beings. I love talking to them. Michael Miller, Jim McGing, thanks for coming in here today.
Hi, John. We're really happy to be here. We're happy you had us back. I'm surprised you had us back.
Yeah, absolutely happy to be here.
Yeah, right, exactly. You guys represent, obviously, Miller and McGing, attorneys at law. You do some great work. Okay, before we get to personal injury, I guess this is fall into that category, because we got a lot of interesting things to talk about, especially about knowing if you have a workers' compensation claim, what to do. That's going to be kind of the crux of our conversation. But I've been watching a lot of golf lately. I've been playing even more of it. Game's not getting any better playing. It's fun to watch, though. I saw a spectator get smacked by a ball at the Ryder Cup. He or she seems okay. From a legal perspective, if you're a spectator at a golf tournament and you get hit, even if, let's say, you were looking the other way or whatever, your fault or not, do you have a case or no?
Probably not, John, because you probably signed your life away when you bought that ticket.
Really? And those things could, like, if you read the back of a baseball ticket, it's on there, too. Those are pretty strong contracts.
Absolutely. They've been challenged. Sometimes you can get around them depending on the circumstances and the facts. But for the most part, when you buy one of those tickets, you're agreeing to sit in that particular area or stand in that area, and you assume the risk. And there have been inroads, there have been cases that have come down where people have been successful litigating them, but it's an uphill battle, and it's not a battle that most people win, unfortunately.
All right, well, you and I are going to go golfing together sometime soon here, Michael.
I just invited you off the air.
Oh, I'm in. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I didn't. Was that not to share? Yeah. Let's say we're out golfing, and this wouldn't be all that unreal. Let's say I hit a ball and I yell four, perhaps, because it's going the wrong way, and I hit someone else. Am I liable for that? What can they sue the golf course? Me? How does that work?
Well, they can sue you for sure for negligence. And here's the interesting thing, that this is something that a lot of people don't know, and that's that your homeowner's insurance, so the homeowner's insurance of the golfer that struck you, covers his negligence, essentially, in hitting an errant shot.
Wait, homeowner's insurance?
Yes, exactly.
On the golf course.
Exactly.
My homeowner's insurance or his?
His. The person that's hitting the golf ball.
Poor guy.
The guy that's just the terrible golfer that hits you with the shot. His homeowner's insurance covers him and his negligence, so if you make a claim against him, it's going to be covered. And a lot of people just don't know that. And that's something. It's an extension of your homeowner's policy. And any acts of negligence on the part of an insured, which is the person that lives in the house, or someone is children, all covered.
Hold on. And Jim McGing, if you have anything, feel free to jump on. But now I got a follow-up. Because I used to be a homeowner, had a homeowner's insurance policy. Now I rent. So am I not covered then because I don't have homeowner's insurance?
If you have renter's insurance, that would cover as
really?
Well.
Really?
Absolutely.
My renter's insurance covers me on a golf cart course when I have an errant shot at someone.
Exactly.
When you're golfing two or three times a week, as you told us before we went on the air.
Now, that was definitely not for public consumption, Jim. Yes. I've been doing a lot. I'm always so curious about it, because I also know that, and this has happened, is you have an errant shot off a tee and it hits through someone's window. That's my responsibility, right, as the bad golfer?
As the bad golfer. And in fact, I used to live on a golf course. I lived on the seventh green of a golf course, and I ended up having, the right side of my house was dented. It looked like, looked like I'd been pelted by hail, continuously.
Every day.
And then the interesting thing is that I found a Titleist in my basement. It had gone through the basement window. And lo and behold, I come home and there's a Titleist golf ball sitting on my basement floor. So, and one went through my dining room window too. So, Suffice it to say, I had to sell the house when my son was born and he started walking because I realized that when he walked around the yard, was not going to end well. So,
would you have had to catch the person when they did it in order to have a case?
Exactly. And that obviously didn't happen in those situations because I was away. I was not home when the thing happened. But my short game was great in those during those years.
Yeah, because you had all of these Titleists you could then use on the course yourself.
Right. And
from your basement.
And I lived right there. So it was an amazing opportunity to improve your short game, but not good for your house.
Yeah. Boy, we're answering a lot of my personal questions here today about my golf game. 312-981-7200 if you guys have any about yours. We get in a lot of texts, people reminding about, you know, in baseball games where they've added the netting now and to help out some people. The Cubs player a couple of years ago, there was a little girl that was hurt. Unfortunately, there's been at a Columbus Blue Jackets hockey game years ago. Unfortunately, a teenage girl died as a result of that. But obviously, it's something to be aware of anytime
you're there. In many of those sports, it's an inability to react. Also, baseball, the ball's coming off so quickly off the bat. Or in hockey, it's coming off, and you've seen that this netting's been added because there have been inroads in these court cases where judges have opened up avenues for liability for plaintiffs.
Yeah, that was a huge controversy when they added the netting. I couldn't wait until they did it. And people are like, well, get off your phones. Do you see how fast those balls are coming at you at 130 miles an hour? I don't care if you're on your phone or not. 312-981-7200, that's the phone number here. But the real reason we brought you here was not to answer all my sporting personal injury questions.
Not golf, John.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about workers' compensation because, you know, the reality of the world today, and it always has been, is that injuries happen on the job, and there's a lot of things you need to know as a worker to make sure that you're going to be covered okay. But there's a lot of things you have to do, right? Because I think a lot of people assume, oh, yeah, there's a policy at work, and this will get carried out fine, and there's a process for these things. No, it's up to the worker to do a lot of the work, the legwork, to make sure that they're okay.
Absolutely. It's up to the worker, John, but it's also up to their attorney to make sure that the case gets handled properly. And that's why we encourage, your listeners, if they do get hurt at work, to call us, because
when we say hurt at work, though, I think a lot of people, I mean, there's cases where you're like, okay, that was obvious. I was at the office or I was at this fell on me. My head hurts. My shoulder's broken. Okay. You got a workers' comp case, perhaps. I mean, but there's got to be cases where injuries happen slowly over time, or maybe you feel something days later. So
sure.
Okay. Well, how do you know if you have a case?
Okay, so one of the things you kind of were touching on there a little bit, John, is repetitive trauma.
Okay,
and repetitive trauma under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act is compensable, and it's usually in the context of carpal tunnel syndrome. You've probably heard of carpal tunnels. Your listeners have heard of carpal tunnel. The checkers at the grocery stores, they're constantly moving items, scanning items all day long, 5 days a week. They are the poster children for getting carpal tunnel syndrome, and I've handled many cases.
The grocery store workers.
The grocery store workers,
because I always picture someone in an office.
Data entry also is a big
one. That makes sense.
Data entry and grocery store workers.
Trades people doing repetitive actions.
Right. So those types of injuries for those types of people, they are compensable under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act under the theory of repetitive trauma, which has been recognized for many, many, many years in Illinois. So those people, they can make workers' compensation claims. And, you always say, well, when was the accident? Well, the accident is deemed to be the first date of medical treatment.
Okay.
So the first day that they go in and they tell the doctor, my wrist, it's all numb. And they say, well, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a checker at, the grocery store. So that's when the light bulbs go off and they have compensable claims under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act, no question.
I bet a lot of folks don't know that they do. Do you find that, Jim? Maybe that even some people like a repetitive case, or maybe they're a part-time worker, or maybe they don't have much education in terms of what workers' compensation may be. They need to get educated on that because they may have a case.
They do. And what we see often is the labor unions, people where they're represented by unions, they do a good job of instructing their members about that, being aware of it. The medical community is very astute at identifying what the cause of these repetitive injuries are from. And when people go to see their doctors, they do a good job of identifying what the cause is, what could be the cause.
Now, I kind of brought up there actually an interesting question, too, about part-time workers versus full-time. Is there a difference in terms of workers' compensation based on what sort of employee you are?
No, they're both covered under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act. The issue you get into with full-time versus part-time is the rate. And that's something I'm going to talk about in a little bit. It was his average weekly wages. How much money does this particular employee make? Because that's the building block of all workers' compensation benefits is the average weekly wage. So if you work part-time, obviously, you're probably making less than someone that works full-time, unless you're really smart. And so that's one of the things that's an important concept is how much did the employee make? And one of the things that Jim and I always do when we get a new workers' compensation case is we get a wage history on the employee because we want to know what they made in those 52 weeks before they were injured because that's the basis for the entire case.
Right.
And one of my I've got my seven things to know if you ever heard in a work heard at work, and that's actually one of the things I was going to talk about is that don't trust the calculation of that particular average weekly wage. Don't leave it to some insurance adjuster. Make sure you or your attorneys calculate it properly because that's how much you're going to get paid every week and how much you're going to get at the end. So you've got to be diligent. One of the things that kind of a saying in our office is trust but verify.
Okay.
So we love to verify by getting that wage history, and that's something Jim has been advocating and I've been advocating for a long time.
Okay, so that is one of the points. We'll expand on it a little bit later. We're going to go through the seven things to do if you get injured at work. I just like to for people to know who we're talking about here. And so we mentioned it could be part-time, it could be full-time, it could be an injury that's obvious or something repetitive over time. What about someone that is self-employed that does contracted work for other people? Because that's an area I know a lot of people are self-employed these days. Maybe they're chasing a different passion than they had before. Are people that are contracted out eligible for workers' compensation?
That's a complicated question. Okay. If you're self-employed, unless you purchase workers' compensation insurance for yourself, there's not going to be any coverage. Now, there's issues that have come up throughout the years of loaned and borrowed employees. So if you're a contract employee and you work for another entity, usually there's an agreement between the entities as to who's going to provide the workers' compensation coverage.
Okay.
So in those cases, there is coverage. But if you're totally self-employed, you're out of luck on workers' comp unless you purchase insurance to cover yourself, which most people don't.
Yeah, and that's maybe something people should certainly consider, especially depends on what they're doing.
Absolutely, especially these days, the way the economy has gone and the way people are working, from home and for themselves.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And what we were talking about, not trusting and verifying, it also goes farther in terms of the identification of what their position is, because oftentimes an employer may designate someone as an independent contractor when they're really not. And if they're not, and there's elements that have to be demonstrated that somebody's really not an independent contractor and that they're actually an employee, then they would be covered under the workers' compensation also.
I don't want to open up a can of worms here, but I know that's what a lot of folks were talking about with Uber and Lyft and some of these ride shares, whether they were contractors or employees. And that was one of the things they were arguing in California was because I want to be insured by this company that I work 40 hours for. We don't have time to get into all of that. But tell you what, we're going to take a commercial break, 312-981-7200 if you have any questions. And then after the break, we're going to break down the seven things you need to know if you get injured at work. Here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. Michael Miller, Jim McGing from Miller & McGing, attorneys at law. We're talking workers' compensation and a lot about my golf game earlier, but we moved on from that, fortunately, for the listener. By the way, I just want to make sure people know exactly where to go if they are interested in your services, if they're maybe driving at home, they're getting out of their car, WGNAccidentAttorneys.com, or they can call 773-467-8000. I'll give those numbers and email out again in just a little bit. Okay. Seven things to know if you get injured at work. And like we've covered, this applies to part-time, full-time, injuries that are obvious or ones that maybe have developed over time. So we've laid the foundation here. So if you think that you have an injury at work, what do you do?
Okay, well, the first thing you need to do, and this is very important, is that you need to make a written report with your employer. Okay?
With your employer?
With your employer. There's a form in Illinois that's used. It's called a Form 45. It's a simple form that your employer fills out, and it documents that you actually had an injury on a particular day and a particular time, and it basically has enough information in there to let everybody know later on, because it's later on when you have the problems,
right,
that there was an injury on that particular date and that particular time. Now, the question I get a lot from people is, you know, my employer won't take a report. They won't fill out a Form 45. They don't know what a Form 45 is.
Really? You know? So they go to HR and the people are like, well, I don't know.
Right. So
that doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good, but you'd be surprised at, you know, how often that these things happen. So, you know, notice is an important element under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act. You have to give, you know, your employer notice that you got hurt, right?
Right.
So what I tell people in that situation is just send an email to your supervisor explaining that you got hurt on a specific date, time, and place and the nature of your injury. That's good enough. That'll suffice, you know.
That's basically Form 45, do-it-yourself.
Do-it-yourself Form 45. And you know what? It's an important thing because you'd be surprised that what happens later on, you know, in the things that I've seen in my practice, that, you know, if it's in the Form 45, you're saved.
Yeah.
You know, because you can document that there was an accident. And a lot of times, John, it's human nature to think that, you know what, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
Especially a lot of, you know, tradesmen, you know, construction workers.
Fight through it.
They fight through it, and they're our heroes, you know.
Right.
But, you know, that human nature tendency to think that I'm going to be okay,
yeah,
is not necessarily good for your workers' compensation case. If you think you've been hurt, you know, in an accident at work, always document it by making a written report via Form 45 or sending an email.
So if you're on the fence, do it.
Exactly. So that's the number one thing.
Right.
You know, and it's the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And it's not uncommon, as Mike said, in the trades for people to think, I'll be okay. You know, my back hurts today. They go home and it's worse. And then they don't report it till the next day. That's okay.
That's okay,
too. Report it.
Right. Yes. No matter what.
They have some time to report it, but do it as soon as it's possible.
Yeah. I like that, too, the idea that there are a lot of people that just want to tough it out, that think that they can. Not me. I stub my toe. I'm writing Form 45. There's so many Form 45s in my file. No, you want to take it for serious cases.
Right.
But if you're ever on the fence, just do it. I mean, you're going to thank yourself later.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I'm not advocating that you do it for every time you stub your toe, exactly
right.
What you said, but it's an important thing.
All right. That's step one.
That's number one.
We got to take another commercial break and then the news, but we've got you guys into the next hour as well. We'll go through the next six steps as well, because this is important stuff. I know there's a lot of listeners right now that may be experiencing this, that may know someone that is. If you have any additional questions, 312-981-7200. And you, no matter what, you can follow up with these guys at WGNAccidentAttorneys.com. Or you can call 773-467-8000. More with the folks from Miller and McGing after this in the news on WGN.
Now, here's John Hansen, and let's get legal.
Thank you very much. That's Ernie, his voice, good friend of mine here at WGN. And you heard him say Miller and McGing, and I've got the two gentlemen right here, Michael Miller and Jim McGing, from the law firm of Miller and McGing. We're talking about workers' compensation if you're just joining us. 312-981-7200 if you've got any questions yourself about who is eligible or what people should do. And that's really where we've pivoted now. The seven things you need to do if you think you have a workers' comp claim. So, Mr. Miller, recap what number one was for us.
Okay, absolutely. Number one is to always make a written report documenting your accident if you happen to get injured at work. And we talked about Form 45.
Yeah.
And if the employer doesn't offer you a Form 45, send an email to your supervisor.
Jim, does that automatically trigger a investigation or what?
What it does is it protects you under the Illinois state statute. You only have 45 days to actually notify your employer.
Whoa.
And you don't want to wait that time. You want to report it right away under Form 45.
45 days seems quick.
It seems quick, but it's better for you to report it immediately. And then what that triggers, that Form 45, is that the employer under state law has to notify the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission that oversees all workers' compensation claims in Illinois. They don't do anything. It doesn't trigger some investigation by them unless there's a serious injury. Then that would be, of course, OSHA and some other regulatory agencies. But what it does is give them notice that there's been an injury, and they begin to take steps once a claim is actually filed by the employee.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. All right. Let's move on. Step number two.
Okay. Number two, John, and this is really, really important. And if you are injured at work, always give a detailed history of what happened when you go see the medical provider.
What happened at work?
Exactly. And by history, I mean explaining how you were injured and what part of your body was injured, basically. And, you know, a lot of people end up in emergency rooms. A lot of people end up at their own doctor. Some folks end up at what, you know, industrial clinics. I call them doc in the boxes, mm-hmm. you know, for lack of a better yeah. term. But, you know, that first visit is really the key, because that's when you're going to explain what happened to you, right?
Right.
And I'll give you an example of like three different histories that you could give, and you could probably figure out which one would be the best one
okay.
for your case. The first one, say somebody hurts their knee, for example. I think I twisted my knee. That's the history. Well, the person writes down, I think I twisted my knee. Well, later on, that particular history would not be very good.
Sounds like a lot of guys I would know. They just go yeah. and be like, I twisted my knee, fix it.
Exactly.
That's no good.
Second type of history that somebody may give is, I twisted my knee at work.
Uh-huh.
Much better.
Yeah, you're getting there.
Much better. But what I suggest and what I'm advocating and trying to tell your listeners here is that what they need to do is be as specific as possible. I caught my foot in a pallet, and I twisted my knee this afternoon at work, and now I have pain on the left side of my knee.
Very specific. And, Jim, you've been on the other side of this as a judge. And you've seen this. I imagine those details that Michael's talking about are so key in cases.
Absolutely. I was the supervising judge of the Tax and Miscellaneous Division in the Law Division for the Circuit Court of Cook County. We heard all workers' compensation appeals in that section.
Oh, for the whole county?
For the entire county. And, you know, I've heard literally hundreds and hundreds of these cases, and that minutia can be really very important in a case.
See, this is why you want Miller and McGing. I'm telling you. You get the Miller, and then you get the McGing. Well, obviously.
You get the good golfer and the not-so-good golfer.
I was wondering how to frame that there, Michael.
I'm not spending so much time golfing.
Yeah, the golfer and the judge.
I'm working exactly. when he's golfing.
All right, what's step three, or most important things to do? Step three if you're injured
okay,
at work.
Okay, so the history we've covered. Okay, so step three is, okay, let's say you are injured at work, okay? Mm-hmm. And now you're going to start receiving benefits. And one of the benefits that you're going to receive right away is called temporary total disability. And what that is it's a calculation based on how much money that you earn. Everybody, you know, has a different wage, you know, that they earn depending on the type of job that they have. So there's a concept called average weekly wage. Now, what is average weekly wage? Well, average weekly wage is basically the 52 weeks before you were injured.
Mm-hmm.
We get a wage history. We want to know what you made that 52 mm-hmm. weeks before you were injured. And then we divide by 52, and that gives us what you make on average. And that's the building block, John, for what your temporary total disability payments are. And the formula is basically two-thirds of your average weekly wage tax-free. And that's what you're going to get paid while you're off of work. Now, the third point here, and this is what I was kind of alluding to earlier, is that, you know, you need to, you know, drill down on that number, because that number is the basis for your temporary total disability, which is what you're going to get paid every week and pay your bills with.
Mm-hmm.
And also later on, how much you could potentially receive in a settlement and an award. And so one of the points, and my third point, is don't necessarily trust the insurance company's calculation of that particular average weekly wage. Do your own due diligence. Have it calculated, you know, through your employer, or if you were to contact us, we'll do it for you.
What about seasonal workers? Because that's not quite a 52-week thing.
Very good question. And that's the snafu that some people run into. A seasonal worker, you know, let's say they're a landscaper, for example, yeah. and they just work, you know, during the spring and summer months. Now, they've only got a partial year to mm-hmm. work with, right? Insurance companies, and I've seen this happen many times, will just, you know, take that partial year, whatever they made, they'll divide by 52. Wrong. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you divide by the actual number of weeks
that were worked. Right.
Exactly. And that's the fair way to do it. That's the legal way to do it. But that's not necessarily the way that it always gets done.
Interesting.
So it's very important that in those situations, if you are a seasonal worker, that you do, you know, contact an attorney, because they will make sure that you get the benefits you're entitled to.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And sometimes those disputes are not easily settled, and they end up being an issue before the arbitrator, before the Illinois Workers' Comp Commission, and if the case is appealed to the circuit court, I've had that issue in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
How was it calculated? And people argue it was calculated incorrectly, and they should have gotten a higher amount.
Right, and it's important to know that at the front end. That saves you a lot of grief in the long run. All right, what's number four?
Well, before we get to number four, John, I want to mention one other thing on number three,
okay.
and that's the inclusion of part-time work in your average weekly wage calculation.
Okay, so gigs on the side and stuff like
exactly.
that?
Exactly. And, you know, these days there's a lot of people that I know, you know, that have to work two jobs to make ends meet.
Right.
And so what the law says is that you can take that, you know, money, you know, from that second job, as long as your employer, your original employer where you were injured, knows that you're working a second job.
Okay.
They have to have that knowledge. And if they have that knowledge, then what we do is we combine both of those wages, and that increases your average weekly wage, which increases your weekly benefits and would increase your settlement at the end. So that's something a lot of people don't know. Include that second job.
That's smart. Okay, now let's move on to number four.
Number four. Okay, this is one of my favorites. Never treat with the insurance company's doctor or clinic. And
you mean know, they'll provide their own. They'll say, go to this guy or gal.
Exactly. It happens, you know, more often than I would like to see in the mm-hmm. world, but it really does. And what I want all of the listeners out there to understand is that you have the absolute right under Illinois law to choose your own doctor. That's a very important concept. You know, that's a real sacred thing, the patient-doctor relationship. And so never let anybody dictate who your doctor should be. You know, so I always tell my clients, you have the absolute right to pick your doctor. In fact, under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act, you have a right to pick a second doctor.
For another opinion?
For a second opinion, yeah. Absolutely. And then there's a little nuance to the rule, and that's that if you get a written referral from one doctor to the next doctor, that second doctor doesn't count as your second doctor. It's part of an infinite chain of referral doctors that you're entitled to. So what I tell all of my clients, and Jim does the same thing, is that if you're injured at work and you need to see a specialist, have your original doctor just write, you know, even if it's on a little prescription pad, you know, go see Dr. Smith. And that protects you, and the insurance company has to pay for it.
Smart.
And that's come back to hurt people, litigants who have been in front of me when I was the supervising judge, where they didn't get that referral, and then they went to other doctors after that, and those bills and whatever they had were not covered under the Workers' Compensation Act.
Interesting. I tell you what, we've got to take a commercial break. We got 5, 6, and 7 coming up for what to do if you were injured at work. Here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We got the great Michael Miller, Jim McGing here, Miller and McGing, talking about workers' compensation. And, Michael, I guess we I didn't know you combined there 4 and 5.
My fault, John. I got ahead of myself.
These are the steps to do if you're injured at work. And we talked about getting never use the insurance company's doctor. You can use your own, and you can always get a referral from your doctor to a second one.
Right, and then that's not deemed to be your second doctor, so you can keep going to see as many doctors as you need to, and the insurance company has to pay for it under the Illinois Workers' Compensation Law.
Great.
But get that written referral. So moving on to number 6, and this is something that comes up quite often,
mm-hmm.
and my mantra on this, and I'll tell you what it is never allow an insurance company to deny you medical treatment, okay? And it sounds good, but how do you do that? Okay, well, Jim and I have come up with kind of a 3-part strategy. If someone is injured at work and the workers' comp insurance company basically says, you know what, we're not going to pay for that. We don't think that's necessary. Or they send you to what's called an IME doctor, independent medical exam doctor, and that doctor sees you for 5 minutes and says, no, you don't need that particular treatment or you don't need that surgery. So in those situations, we've developed a strategy. And the first thing that we go to is we ask our client, do you have group health insurance?
Because mm-hmm.
if you have group health insurance and you have a denial from workers' comp, then typically group health will have to cover it because it's denied.
Okay.
So we seek out their group health insurance. And sometimes that'll work, and then we can reimburse them later, mm-hmm. you know, if we're successful in
getting the treatment.
Case. Get the treatment. Okay. So that's number one. The second one, let's say the person doesn't have group health insurance.
Okay.
Then what I do is I get on the phone and I talk to the particular provider and I give them a letter of protection. And I tell them, listen, this person needs this treatment. You recommended it. You know they need the treatment. And I'm going to win this case, so I'm going to give you a letter of protection, and we will take care of this out of on the back end.
Jim, is Michael always this confident? Because I do not want to talk to him on the other end of a phone call like this.
He's very confident, yes.
I don't want to mess with you when you're in that mode. You're a nice guy, but you got this look in your eyes right now when you're talking.
When it comes to denying my clients medical treatment, I get downright medieval.
I was going to say.
because that's one of my pet peeves. I want my clients to recover. I want them to go back to work. I want them to feel better. And, you know, when an insurance company doesn't want to pay for things, it just kind of screws everything up. So that you'd be surprised that that letter of protection means a lot to these providers, especially for me, because they know that I'm going to, you know, go after that and I'm going to win it. And then the third thing that we can do is what's called a 19B petition. And this is something that's specific under the Workers' Compensation Act, where we can actually file a petition to seek these medical benefits if they're not being provided and get a hearing in front of an arbitrator. But, you know, long before I get to the 19B, usually number one or number two works. So my clients get their medical treatment, and that's what I'm most proud of, actually.
It's important. And number one, I mean, your health is number one.
Absolutely.
Right. For sure. All right. Here it is, drum roll, the seventh thing to do if you get injured at work.
Okay. Now, this applies to situations where, you know, somebody has a pretty significant injury and they're going to be off of work for a long time. So now we're kind of long into the case, you know? And oftentimes when that happens, John, the insurance company will provide a rehabilitation nurse to take, you know, to go to the client's appointments, to follow their progress, to see their treatment. Sounds real nice, right?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? It's not so nice, because a lot of the rehabilitation nurses are kind of there to prod the person along to get them back to work maybe before they're
I've seen this on TV shows.
Yeah.
Are you telling me the insurance guys? I'm beginning to think that they're the bad guys here.
Well, they're not
always the bad guys.
They're
not always
the bad
that.
Guys. We love insurance companies, but we, you know, we got to rein them in sometimes and make sure that they follow the law.
Right.
I mean, I just want people to follow the law. So one of the, my number seven rule here is never to let the rehabilitation nurse talk to your doctor without you there.
Makes sense to me.
Absolutely. And you'd be surprised at how often they try to talk to the doctors without the clients being present. And if they're discussing your health, John, you've got a right to be there. Okay. So when I talk to rehabilitation nurses, you know, generally what I tell them is, you know what, just make sure my client's present when you talk to the doctor, number one. Number two, send me copies of everything that you send to the insurance company. If you can live with those two rules, welcome to the case.
And it's following up really quickly on that. I mean, should you be taking notes whenever possible for this stuff, so remember stuff for your recollection?
It's not a bad idea to do that, John. Yeah. You know, a lot of people, you know, don't do that, but yeah, you're thinking ahead, and like we said, you know,
I'm a smart guy.
Well, we made some suggestions to you off the air. I hope you follow them.
Oh, yeah,
that's actually a great thought about making notes. We've also had clients who have recorded their examinations with doctors, because they oftentimes will tell us that they reference something to the doctor, and the doctor is listening to them, maybe taking notes, maybe entering that information later on, and trying to rely on their own memory. And oftentimes it doesn't reflect word for word what the patient has said to them.
Now, we are a two-party consent state, so I think the doctor has to know you're recording.
Yeah, they ask. And we've had clients who have asked their doctors because they said, oh, my husband can't come in, my spouse can't come in, whoever it is, and they've allowed them to record it, and then there's no issue.
That's a good idea. Gentlemen, we only have 2 minutes left. I know we want to talk about some other things here. You want to talk about COVID-19 protections for first responders?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's a great topic.
Why don't we just jump into that right away? So there's a what's called a rebuttable presumption for a number of workers in Illinois if they were diagnosed with COVID. And those are first responders, police, fire, paramedics. Those are frontline workers, medical staff, nursing home workers, rehabilitation center workers, and then necessary workers, which was a designation that the governor gave to
grocery
workers, a whole number of people in different industries. Although there's a caveat for the necessary workers, the place of employment has to have a minimum 15 employees, and they have to encounter the public as part of the duties of their job. And that presumption is rebuttable, which means that the employer can present some evidence to rebut that at the Illinois Workers' Comp Commission. And they can do that by showing that if you work from home, you're not covered.
Okay.
If you were on leave, you're not going to be covered either if together there's at least 14 days prior to the date of your injury. And
the injury in this case is getting COVID.
Correct, right. Yes. And they also follow, if the employer followed the CDC or Illinois Department of Public Health guidelines and provided PPE equipment to their employees, that can rebut the presumption. And then lastly, which is the most obvious, if they can expose some alternative source of how you obtained COVID. Maybe you were at a family wedding and there was an outbreak. and they're able to point to that. So that presumption helps all of those workers in their workers' comp cases. And we're talking about serious injuries, long-termers.
Long haulers.
Long haulers.
Which is a serious thing, for sure.
And the presumption was for a period of time. It started March 9th of 2020, and it went until June 30th of 21, and that's the date of injury that you were unable to actually continue work because of a diagnosis of COVID, or you had symptoms during that period and were unable to work.
Let me tell you something, listeners. We got to go to the news, but these two know what they're talking about. Seriously, they're good people, and they're going to help you out, and they have a bunch of other notes that we didn't have time to get to. We'll get to it next time. Promise you that. Michael Miller, Jim McGing from Miller & McGing. Thank you guys so much for stopping on by. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. WGNAccidentAttorneys.com. WGNAccidentAttorneys.com. Call 773-467-8000. 773-467-8000. I'm reading these twice because these guys know what they're talking about, Miller and McGing. Take care, guys. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks.
Time for the news on WGN. Ooh, that commercial gave me goosebumps. Blackhawks back in action. Can't believe Wednesday night at the United Center. I'll be there. I hope you will be, too. If not, of course, keeping it here on 720 WGN all season long. Should be a fun one for the Chicago Blackhawks. Really looking forward to that. Okay, this COVID time has been so hard on many different industries, but I think the restaurant industry particularly has been hit hard. And, I mean, we here on WGN have talked about it so often, and about restaurants shutting down and finding out ways to, in order to operate. But something I hadn't even considered, and maybe it's just because I just don't think this way, but restaurants potentially asking their insurance companies to help cover some of the costs of losing all that business. Some have been successful, some have not. Let's talk with Neil Gainsburg, founder of Gainsburg Law. He joins me now in the studio. Neil, how are you doing here today?
Doing good.
I guess I just don't have the legal brain for this sort of thing, but it is interesting. I mean, law, I know that insurance cases are different in every single sort of state, but here in Illinois, restaurants, if they have insurance for their restaurant, should they be able to ask insurance to cover some of the bill for them?
Yes, that's the purpose of insurance.
Right?
Insurance, what you think of insurance is, you know, your typical car accident. Somebody mm-hmm. runs into your car. You definitely should be able to make a claim with their insurance company, and they should pay for the damages to your car.
Right.
Here, a business like a restaurant has insurance for loss of income,
okay.
meaning that if something happens and they can't operate their business or their restaurant, they would expect their insurance company to step in and to pay that difference of what they lost. That's what a loss is. So in this case, the coronavirus hits, COVID hits. The state, the governor shuts down the restaurant, says you can't operate. They think that's a loss. I can't operate my business. I can't make income. I have coverage for business income. Just like if somebody rear-ends your car, you have coverage on your car. You expect somebody to pay for your car. They expected somebody to pay for their income they lost because the restaurant was shut down.
Do you see a lot of restaurants asking their insurance companies for money?
Yes. There has been many, many restaurants, especially the bigger restaurant groups have, brought claims against their insurance companies for these business policies seeking business income loss. Not because their business suffered the typical catastrophe or loss of like the fire.
Right.
Or somebody stealing all their stuff or the oven exploding.
Right.
That didn't happen, but their restaurant nonetheless was shut down and they suffered a loss, so they tried to claim losses under their policy coverage.
Does it come down to how the insurance policy is written? Because obviously, I don't think anyone really, and maybe we should have, anticipated something like this, like a public health emergency. Do many of these insurance, you know, agreements have public health emergency written in the language?
No, a lot didn't anticipate a pandemic.
Right.
However, there are some provisions in insurance policies. There is a virus exclusion.
Oh, really?
Yes. In many business policies, it says if something is related to a virus, then it is excluded unless there's physical damage. But like the virus situation has been sort of anticipated. There has been some sort of virus if that's affecting stuff. So some of these policies do address it. But the general coronavirus pandemic where
right.
the state shuts down your restaurant, you can't operate even if you want to. I don't think that's really been anticipated in these policies. But insurance companies and their corporations have tried to anticipate losses similar to this.
And how successful are restaurants in
restaurants
getting money?
Restaurants have not been, from what my experiences and from what I've seen, especially in Illinois, they have not been successful.
Most
cases have looked at what the policy says. And when you're interpreting insurance contracts or insurance policies, you interpret it based on like a contract. What is written?
Mm-hmm.
You interpret the words, the ordinary meaning of the words. And every one of these provisions, when you talk about business income, talks about physical loss, an actual physical, again, a fire. somebody stealing your property, the oven exploding. It doesn't talk about just your business being shut down because of a pandemic or because of a state closure. There's some sort of physical aspect to the loss. And the courts pretty much, not all of them, some judges have said otherwise, have said, we don't see any physical damage here. Therefore, there's no coverage.
Interesting. But someone could argue that the physical tape that the governor put over the doors to close them for a little bit, or certain specific municipality leaders or whatever the case may be, was a physical damage in a way. But they actually want to see, I hate to put it for lack of a better word, rubble to make it something that they say is covered.
Yes, they want to see some sort of physical loss. And that was basically the restaurant's argument, is that the government shutting them down meant they had the physical loss of or use of the property. They could not use the property. They could not do their business on the property. They could not operate a business. So that's a physical loss of the property.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts have said, no, physical means, as you said, rubble, tangible, something that you could actually feel, something that you could see, not just some sort of general loss. Mm-hmm.
Is this something that's going to have to work its way through the courts in order for us to get a little bit more sense on what the judicial system feels like? This is this a state thing? I just wonder, like, if someone gets denied insurance coverage, you know, these restaurants might go out of business. How are they supposed to fight this sort of thing?
So how it works in the court system is that most of these cases are in federal court because the individual restaurants here in Illinois are Illinois-based restaurants. The insurance companies are based out of a different state. It might be Wisconsin, Cincinnati, it could be a different state. So it's a diversity of jurisdiction, which leads it to the federal courts. So most of the federal courts are determining this. And right now we're on the district court level, the lower level, the trial court level of the federal courts. And eventually it has to work its way up the channel and go up to the intermediate or appellate level. And in that stage of the system, or the stage of the judicial system, the courts will make a decision as to whether these policies are covered. But it looks like many of these restaurant groups have, you know, attorneys, and they're ready to fight all the way up the appellate chain, maybe all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and that'll be fascinating to see which way that goes, and that would then certainly trickle down to apply to a lot of restaurants potentially. But again, each individual insurance policy is different, right? Like, there, or are there blanket, you know, boilerplate language for a lot of restaurant insurance policies? I guess they're all kind of different, right?
Right. I mean, insurance policies have boilerplate language. You know, most, like, auto insurance policies, whether you get a policy from any of the big insurance companies, they're going to have similar language in it. Boilerplate language, as you said. But there are distinctions in grammar and other sentences that are in there that courts can then use to read the ordinary meaning of the words. And so some insurance companies might say of loss, or policies may say of loss, some may say direct loss, and those types of wording can make a difference as to how the courts rule. So there are several insurance companies that are being sued in this regard for the coronavirus, and some of the policies have different language when it comes to physical loss, and that's why some courts have ruled in favor of the restaurants or the businesses and finding that there may be coverage for a business loss.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, to get a payout, or like to determine how much of a payout it gets, do they just compare it to previous years at a certain time, what sort of income it was compared to a normal year, and that's the basis they use to try and compensate you that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's an audit, basically, of what your tax returns and what your financial documents show as to what you were earning before the pandemic, and you look at what type of income you expected to get, and you look at past years to see the type of income that was reasonable and ordinary for that type of business. And then auditors will come in there, and the insurance company has their own experts to determine what the type of income should have been expected during the covered period or during the loss.
I know that a lot of restaurant groups might have the power or the money to pay lawyers to be able to fight this. Have you seen mom and pop restaurants or smaller runs that have just shut down that they just don't have the resources to be able to fight their insurance company on this?
Yeah, that is an issue. So bigger restaurant chains that, you know, own many, many restaurants, bigger companies, they do have more resources. So they could fight it. They can go to court and they can go, you know, appeal decisions that are not favorable. And the smaller restaurants, they either have to find a lawyer that maybe gives them a little bit of a break, or does it on a contingency basis, saying that the lawyer will take a percentage of any winnings that obtained. But I don't know a lot of lawyers that are doing this on contingency basis, because it's a risk. It's a risk for the lawyer to take this, and it's a risk for the business. And most courts, as I said earlier, are just coming down on the favor of the insurance companies because the policies talk about direct physical loss. And here we just did not have a physical loss. We had no rubble, as you said.
So it's really judge to judge on how this gets determined.
At this level, at the district court level, at the trial court level, yes, each judge makes its own decision. And when there's a contradiction, when there's competing decisions, then one will appeal it to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the next level up, the appellate level, and they'll make a decision. They'll be binding on all the district court judges. And if the Seventh Circuit, which is the federal district court or federal circuit here in Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, has a different decision than the Ninth Circuit out west or the Second Circuit out east, then the U.S. Supreme Court would be the final arbitrator of those competing decisions as to the interpretation of the policy.
This came across my radar because of the Chicago Rosebud chain. They failed, according to this judge, to state a case against its insurance carrier for denying coverage for the business income it lost. When they say failed to state a case, is it just simply they failed to make the case, the argument? Or was there something else at play in this case from what you know?
Yeah, basically they could not prove that their policy of insurance provided coverage for the loss. So that's basically what the court is saying. It was on a motion to dismiss. The court had the insurance policy as part of the pleadings, the documents that are filed before the court. So the court could rule based on what the insurance policy says and interpret the insurance policy language on the pleadings level and determine whether there is a legal basis for the restaurant's claim.
I know a lot of people must be listening and saying, I mean, come on, give these restaurants a break. Clearly, this was never foreseen in a certain way, and it's obvious to people that that's why they've lost all this income. Is there some, though, I imagine some concerns from the judge's perspective is, yeah, okay, you feel that way, but you can't often do that. I mean, you can't just, you know, say, all right, fine, that you're right, that's the case, because potentially restaurants could argue other things, or it could open up the doors for people trying to, you know, find other loopholes in insurance. You kind of have to go by the letter of the policy in order to kind of uphold the entire insurance relationship with some of their clients.
Yes, not all losses are covered.
Yeah,
that's why we have 30, 40 page insurance policy documents that have to be read. There's exclusions in them. There's a lot of exclusions. There's a lot of different ways that a loss that a business may suffer is not covered.
Yeah.
And that's how insurance companies remain in business. They don't insure everything. You think you go out there and you buy insurance, and typically for the consumer, yes, they're going to buy insurance on their car and there's a car accident, it's going to be covered. But if something else happens, there's a windstorm or something like that, an exclusion may apply. And there may
right.
be other issues in how insurance was purchased that may stop insurance from covering stuff. So not everything is automatically covered. There's a lot of issues, legal, practical, public policy-wise, that go into the creation of an insurance relationship between an insured, a business, and that's why sometimes there's no coverage,
Neil,
based on that terms.
Yeah, how long do you anticipate some of this taking? Because, I mean, a lot of restaurants can't just, you know, they're still suffering in many ways. This Delta variant has really harmed restaurants just as they were kind of getting back into the swing of things. This could take some time.
Right. I mean, there may be some restaurants that have no recourse at this point. There's limitations in these insurance policies. You only have a certain period of time to bring an action or a claim or to go to court. And if they haven't done it by now, since we're in year two, pretty much 2.5 years, I would say, of COVID, that they may not have any other recourse now. They can't claim now 2.5 years later that they've lost stuff. They may be time barred because you have a certain period of time that a restaurant must act on a claim, file the claim, go to court if necessary.
All right.
But for these other cases, now that there's competing decisions, conflicting decisions, it's going to take a while to get up the appellate level. It could be a year, it could be 2 years. And if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, it could be several years before some of these restaurants that have filed claims, filed suits, and are waiting to hear whether they will have a viable claim, get a ruling from the final arbitrator or final court on their claim.
All right. GainsburgLaw.com, GainsburgLaw.com. What sorts of work do you do, Neil?
A lot
of insurance stuff?
Yes, I do insurance work. I represent policyholders and first-party claims. I also represent third-party claims. I represent people been injured in accidents, people who have property damage loss, people who have life insurance claims. I usually represent individuals, people, victims of some sort of catastrophe, unfortunately, and they need to make a claim against a business or insurance company, and they have been denied, and we are out there to help the little person,
yeah,
the victims of this.
Yeah, and I imagine that's important, right? Because this is not a world that is navigable on your own, right?
No. If you ever suffer a loss, whether it's just a car accident, whether you fall down somewhere at a business or something like that, you should always, or whether you get hurt on the job, You right. should always seek an attorney to make sure that your rights are protected, because the law is not easy. The law is complicated. The insurance companies, they know what their rights are. They, right. The businesses know. They have attorneys on staff. They have people to make, you know, the rules that they want
followed. Lots of people often.
Lots of people. You individual person who's going through this victim first time, you don't want to be dealing with a big insurance company, a big business by yourself. You want an attorney to be there to protect your rights, to make sure justice prevails for you.
Yeah, it's important stuff. GainsburgLaw.com. But we brought you on for your expertise today and really appreciate you sharing this information. Okay, Neil?
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
For sure. Okay. A quick break and then we'll take a couple callers. I want to play a little game. We usually end things with weird laws or movie things. I've got strange lawsuits and I want some callers to get on the line, 312-981-7200 to finish the strange lawsuit. We have one guy in 1993 suing beer companies for what? Someone sued Anheuser-Busch for $10,000 for what? His name was Richard. He claims that the company claimed one thing and it didn't deliver. What was that? 312-981-7200. We'll wrap things up next here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I love Miller and McGing. John Hansen here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Also Neil, our last guest, too. But those guys are great. Ron Braun, how are you doing here on this Saturday night?
I'm doing great. I love it here. And I love the show. It's always a lot of fun.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, we don't normally get to interact, maybe towards the end of the show. But since we're in the primetime hours here, the evening hours, Ron, it's good to see you.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm a little bit busy, you know, juggling some things and getting the news on the air. But you know what that's like. It's a full-time job.
I hear you, my friend. And Iridian on the other side of the glass, you doing good on the Saturday night, Iridian?
I'm doing great, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for asking. No one ever follows up and asks me. I appreciate that. So I got a couple crazy lawsuits to end the show with today. 1993, a guy sued Anheuser-Busch for $10,000. Iridian, any guesses why he sued a beer company? He said that what? They didn't what? The beer didn't what?
I was going to say they cut him off, but that's not at all.
That's a bad sign. When a bartender cuts you off, that's one thing. When an entire Anheuser-Busch company cuts you off, boy, you got some problems. Ron, any guesses?
I do. I'm a beer drinker, and I think I would sue for $10,000 if I thought that it did not leave a big foamy head like they did in the commercials.
That's a good one. No, it isn't that, but that's interesting, right? That they show that you know, it's all about the pour. You got to tilt the glass the right way or not. No, they sued because Richard Overton in 1993 for $10,000 for false advertising. He said that the commercials made beer drinking look fun and that you'd get attractive women at your side and all that. Instead, it caused him distress and financial loss.
Oh, and no ladies.
Right, and no ladies. And Ron, I'm just like, well, yeah, that we all know that, right? Come on, we know the real story about it.
What happened to that lawsuit? How quickly did that get thrown out?
Well, I have here on my notes is, quote, plaintiff lost.
No. I'm quite sure.
Shock. Really quickly, one last one here. A man sued Michael Jordan and Nike for $800 million because why? Why did he sue Michael Jordan and Nike for $800 million? Iridian, any guesses?
The shoes didn't make him play like Michael Jordan.
That's a good one there. No, that's not the answer. That's a good guess. So, Ron, anything?
I was going to say something similar, that they did not make him fly.
Yeah, right? No, right? Exactly. Like, and he didn't end up like Mike. No, in fact, he is very much like Mike. He looks exactly like Michael Jordan. He's from Portland. His name is Alan Ray Heckard, and he's sued because he says he's been confused for Michael Jordan every day for the last 15 years. It's caused him permanent injury and emotional pain. He later dropped the charges without giving a reason. But I guess I could see that. I mean, especially if it's Michael Jordan, like, you must every day be like, you know, my life is not all that great compared to that guy.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you look like Michael Jordan. That was a handsome man, and people would mistake him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a heck of a lot better than, you know, the beer drinking lawsuits.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I mean, I was going to say, use that to make some money.
Exactly.
Take pictures on the street, sign fake autographs, do what you got to do, although you'll probably get a lawsuit on the other end. Ron, thanks for playing along. Iridian, thanks so much, too. I'm not here next week for Let's Get Legal. Matt Bubala is filling in. It'll be a great show from 3 to 5 next Saturday. I'm attending my friend's wedding. Have a great rest of your night, everyone. News coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.